Welcome to the Pursuit of Learning podcast. I'm your host, Clint Murphy. My goal is for each of us to grow personally, professionally, and financially, one conversation at a time. To do that, we will have conversations with subject matter experts across a variety of modalities. My job as your host will be to dig out those golden nuggets of wisdom that will facilitate our growth. Join me on this pursuit. Today, I have the pleasure of having Lane Kawaoka on the Pursuit of Learning podcast. Lane currently owns 4,200 plus units across the United States. He lives in Hawaii and recently quit his day job as an engineer. Lane partners with investors who want to build their portfolio alongside him. Investors who are too busy to mess with tenants, toilets, and termites. They have acquired over $350 million of real estate by syndicating over $40 million of private equity since 2016. Lane reverse engineers the wealth building strategies that the rich use in the top 50 investing podcasts. SimplePassiveCashflow.com. His mission is to help hardworking professionals out of the rat race, one free strategy call at a time. Lane and I talk about his path from employee to owning 4,000 plus units across the country. Along the way, we cover turnkey single family rentals, out of state investing, syndicated multifamily investing, real estate rules of thumb, and real estate financial analytics. We also discuss what markets across the country Lane is targeting and why he targets those markets, amongst many other things. At 35 years of age, Lane has achieved a lot, and he shares how you can too. I hope that you enjoy this conversation as much as I did. Lane, welcome to the Pursuit of Learning. It's great to have you. One of the things that I saw from your background was that you grew up in Hawaii, and you said that the sense of community that you had from growing up there is something that you infused around your business. Can you tell me what you learned through growing up in Hawaii and how that's informed your business philosophy?
Yeah, so Hawaii, for people who haven't visited, you know, it's a lot smaller market. It is an American state, although it is very different from the mainland USA, a lot more community-based, a lot more based in people around you. Things are slower. That's where the old island mentality comes from. I think it's no different than any other small town, Midwestern farm town. But, you know, I mean, I think in the world today, I think there's missing of community. And especially like when I was in Seattle, I don't know my neighbor. I don't know their name. We say hi to each other, then they get inside the house because they're going to rob each other or something like that. But that's just how it is. And in Hawaii, it's just more community-based. And I think when people, high net worth people, the thing I've kind of gotten from them is, you know, you've got it all and money's not an object. It's the relationships, which is the currency of the rich. And people are much more community-based. Everybody knows their neighbor. I mean, I lived in Seattle for 12 years, and dude, I couldn't even tell you who my neighbor's name was, right? You say hi, but nobody hangs out, right? Very different way of life in Hawaii, very family-oriented, very community-oriented. And you know, I kind of created more of a boutique syndication company as I kind of went along to emulate that, where, you know, I mean, you don't need to invest with me, but you know, like people who are around, they enjoy the company, right? They enjoy being with other people, like-minded people especially.
So it's not just a business, it's a group of people that spend time together and enjoy each other's company. Is that fair to say?
Pretty much, right? But, you know, I think there's a couple of things I picked up along the way as I started to expand my peer group to more high net worth folks. And I guess you hear about it a lot of times, but, you know, they say the relationships are the currency of the wealthy, right? Or your network is your net worth. So those are kind of two opposite ends of the spectrum advice, but you know, they kind of go hand in hand. I mean, as you start to grow your network, as we'll kind of dig into it, you know, syndication deals, private placements, or country club deals, you don't get opportunities unless you are in the cool kids club. around other high net worth people. You know, some things to talk about, like what kids your private school are going to, how are you building your family legacy, right? What are you going to do with your sub-$1 million net worth, you know, to kind of create a lasting impact for some kind of philanthropy goal? You know, you can't talk about that stuff with people at work, right? They're all figuring out what to do with their retirement, the very little bit that's left, right? It's just different things to talk about, you know, definitely first world problems.
So when you think about your children someday and what school they'll go to, one of the things you think about is not necessarily what they're going to learn at school, but who they're going to be spending their time with, because that's going to have a long-term implication on their ability to have access to some of these opportunities.
Right. I mean, it's all the whole nature versus nurture thing, right? And school, I mean, I'm not a big fan of school, even though I've got, you know, a master's degree and definitely a product of the system. But I don't think school is for everybody. I do think it's for most people. And that's why most people should have jobs. But I don't think it is for everybody. And so everybody's different. Everybody has a different skill set. Most people don't have a skill set that makes them unique, to be honest. And now that sounds a little glim, but that's why there's jobs, right? That's why most people should be working jobs. But, you know, everybody has different kids. Everybody has different skill sets. And I guess the important thing is for people to be put into the right place. And for those of, you know, people who kind of see the entrepreneurial world, you see this, right? You see both sides of it. But if you're just kind of just a W-2 worker, even though you're a high paid, you know, computer science engineer or doctor, dentist, likely you've gone through the traditional academic path, right? And that's all you may know. And you may not have the offspring that is thinking that way or geared up that way.
That's right. And you said at one point you were a product of the system. So you left Hawaii, you went to Washington, and you did your bachelor's and your master's in engineering. When you were growing up, is engineering where you thought you would be? Or how did you carve that path for yourself?
Two main things. I mean, I think I must have been good at math and science when I was 8 or 9. So kind of got put into this path of being an engineer, right? I mean, straight up, I don't want to be an engineer. All I knew, I just didn't want to be broke, right? And then maybe along the way when I was 12 or 13, I'm 35 now, so, you know, we had Google back then. Only the smart kids were using Google back then. Everybody, the rest of the world was only still using MSN and all those garbage, also Vista and those things. But yeah, I remember Googling highest paid salaries out of college, my elementary school, and engineer was on top. Right. And I was like, yeah, I don't want to go to no grad school. I don't need to get, you know, I want the best. I want the best pay without super long time in school. So maybe that's why I did it.
The best pay without having to get a PhD. And it's amazing how many people don't actually do that research in advance of choosing what degree they're going to get. Often they'll go to university and rack up all that debt. And we'll talk about the value of certain types of debt at some point, I'm sure, without the thought of how am I going to pay this off in the future? Or why am I taking on this debt? What am I going to get out of it?
Right. I mean, a lot of people just go into debt and because they think that that's the best way to do. And, you know, but I think the saddest folks are the people who have the money to go and they just go because their parents will pay for them. I mean, they're just kind of just flushed through the system and, you know, definitely don't appreciate it as much. And they just kind of squander the opportunity.
So then when you graduated, you took a job as a supervisor for a railroad maintenance crew with mostly 50 plus year old colleagues who you were supervising. And I think that's when you started to already realize maybe this 9-to-5 isn't a fit for me and I should be thinking of something else. Can you tell me about some of the things that that job taught you on your path? And why you maybe already started to see that this wouldn't be your long-term future?
Well, I mean, it's just a lot of hours, right? I mean, it was 100% travel for work. I was a management trainee. So, you know, you're given that job kind of as a green kid out of college. And it's, you know, most guys will spend 10, 20 years to get that type of job from the ranks. But what better way that's actually a good system, right? Like you have management trainees who are college educated, go through these types of in the trenches jobs. And it helped me a lot to build my leadership skills, learn a technical background. You know, we had a lot of machinery. We had very high stress kind of decisions that we had to make in the minute. And the whole people aspect of, especially working with a blue collar union workforce, was very eye-opening to me back then. And it's really helped me kind of in my business today. I mean, it's kind of a lot easier today, kind of doing the things that I'm doing today compared to then. In all, you know, weird hours, 24/7, 365, you have emergencies here or there. And they paid me well, I mean, paid me great. Definitely more than 10, 20% than what a normal job I would have been making at, or in Boeing or something like that, building some airplanes or pushing some paper or making emails here and there.
And one of the benefits that I understand from that actually was the fact that it allowed you to become an accidental landlord with your first single family residential purchase. So can you tell us how that job contributed to you being an accidental landlord? And then we'll dive into the path that eventually put you onto.
Yeah, so all the way up to this point, you know, nothing special, right? I mean, I'm just following this linear path. Go to school, study hard, be a good little boy, go work at that job for 40, 50 years, put money into your retirement system. And oh, along the way, buy a house to live in, have a dog, get a wife, have some kids, right?
Save 10% of your income, put it away. It's going to be enough.
Exactly. Yeah. The government will look out for you, right? Pensions.
Exactly.
Well, most of us don't believe in pensions and Social Security these days, but, you know, I mean, I still go a long way. All right, I'm going to go buy a house to live in, right? And I have a salary that I, you know, I was pretty frugal back then, still am a little bit, but I was able to save, you know, like 40, 50 grand of my paycheck every year. So in a couple of years, I saved enough to go buy a $350,000 house in Seattle. And because I was never home, you know, I was working on the road all the time, I was like, this is dumb. Why don't I just rent this thing out and make some money? So the rents were $2,200 a month. The mortgage was $1,600 a month. I knew nothing about the rent-to-value ratio, the 1% rule, the 50% rule, which you can talk about later. All I knew, I was like, you know, cash flowing. I was making some money every month, right? Like at least $400 or $500 was of beer money every single month. And I was like, shoot, if I just keep doing this a couple few more times, I'll be able to like quit my day job or take a easier. And that's where it kind of started. And, you know, with a lot of time on the road, people who've done that, you got a lot of thinking time. So I got the thinking and strategizing on how to do this better and better.
Perfect. And we're going to come back to the next steps and the fact that that lit the spark. Something you said reminded me of something I saw in your videos, and you talked about frugality. And frugality at that stage in your career, when you're trying to put these big down payments out to buy homes, is relatively important. And I saw that you actually had a really great list of some of the things that you did to save money when you were earlier in your career. Can you highlight two or three of the ones that the listener will find quite entertaining, but they actually work, and describe what you were doing?
Yeah, geez, kind of some of them are kind of embarrassing. Like if people have like a Mod Pizza or Pieology around them, it's kind of a little secret or hack that if you can get the salad, you get unlimited toppings. So you just load that sucker up and now you got like lunch for the whole week. When I was working a lot, or when I was working, you know, when you go 30 miles outside of your home office area, now you're on expenses. Cha-ching. So I would strategically come back and go to this casino buffet every weekend. And I would just intermittent fast the next day. And then I would kind of head back on Sunday and then, you know, go right back on expenses. There'd be like a month where it was kind of a game where I would only spend $100 out of my own pocket. Yeah, I would charge my anchor battery box at work. You know, I don't know if that's super legal or not, but I don't know. Just too much time on my hands, to be honest. You know, like time was not valuable back then for me. So I would screw around and do a lot of this type of stuff. And people can check out my whole laundry list of things at simplepassivecashflow.com/cheapo if you want some fun ideas there.
Yeah. We'll put that in the show notes. So any of the links you share, we'll have in the show notes for people to go through later. I absolutely love that list. I used to write and talk about financial independence a lot. Real estate investing, obviously, being a path to that. A lot more of it, it's like dieting. 80% is via not spending money. So all of the hacks you had as ways to save money were ingenious, and I really enjoyed them. And I quite liked the intermittent fasting, not only for fitness, but financial health. That's something I actually wrote about once.
Yeah, pair habits, right? I used to watch a lot, or I used to read a lot of financial blogs in the PF blogs viewer in my college days, but you start to realize that there's a very different mindset between the stuff, the world I'm in and people I interact with, and those personal finance bloggers, like the Mr. Money Mustache guys. You know, they're all into the $5 latte rule, right? Where if you don't drink your latte, you know, you'll have $20,000 after in 5 years, right? And
yeah,
they're very into index funds and retail investments. And that's the fundamental thing that I think that's wrong, is the retail investments, but more so in the attitude, right? Like, you know, if you kind of break down the frugality mindset, you know, the lean fire mindset, it's all about like living less, right? It's like, I'm going to save up $1.2 million and live off of it for the rest of my life. I'm going to live like a hermit and never interact with anybody and help anybody, right? Like I definitely am in the fat fire category. And for those people who don't know, there's different layers of the FIRE, Financial Independence Retirement Extreme. Kind of read some of these guys' blogs, it's kind of lame, right? They just save up $1.2 million, they quit their six-figure job, and they go to Thailand and take pictures of their food, and they don't help out any soul. I mean, it's just very, I don't know, I'll call them out. It's immature, right? Because I had the same mindset when I bought that first rental, then I bought a few more. And then you start to adopt this mindset of like, you know, the light's at the end of the tunnel for me. I mean, yeah, I'm still working this day job, and I eventually did work it for another, you know, almost 10 years. But I started to realize that, yeah, I'm on the way out. And what am I going to do after that, right? Like, am I just going to go on a beach and drink a bunch of pina coladas and do nothing with my time? I mean, that's kind of cool. I get it, you know? But if you really start to think about it really hard, you really start to empathize with that situation, they're like, this is kind of lame, right? Like,
that's right. That's right. Everyone's fire is different. And I think the path that you're on, I very much align with as the same path that I'm on. I look at it as lean fire, fat fire, and then the third one that I generally put in there is pivot. And I would say from what I've read on your path, you as well are somewhere in between that fat fire and that pivot, in that I don't think anyone would look at what you're doing today and say, yeah, he's retired. But I think I would look at what you do today and say, he's doing what he loves. He's enjoying it. He's helping people, and he's making money along the way. And so you transition from being a W-2 employee for someone to living the life you want to do, doing what you want, when you want, how you want it, where you want it. Is that fair to say?
Right. And if people want to Google another term, ikigai, it's the alignment of, you know, something you're good at, your talents align with your what you're doing. You enjoy doing it. You make money by doing it. And it's something the world generally needs.
That's right. I saw that at the end of one of your videos, and it's something I've shared with a lot of the people in one of my communities that I'm a part of, is finding that mix between passion, purpose, what you're good at, what people will pay you for. I think that's a great thing for people to look up.
I think like some people could say, yeah, we're shaming people who haven't found this ikigai, but look, I never had it before, but I think like, I call this like the path to enlightenment. Well, maybe I shouldn't call it like that because it's kind of hokey, right? But it's like a path on the highway, right? The highway is when you start to go really fast. And it's obviously how we've kind of created our highway system. But there's multiple ways onto the highway. There's multiple on-ramps. Some people, like myself, it's money. Money is important to me. Money allows me to feel comfortable and to get to myself a point where I can figuratively put my own oxygen mask on and help others. Now, some other people I notice, like, you know, they're really into the Beachbody thing and they work out a lot, right? And that may be their on-ramp to kind of send the elevator back down for others. Now, however it is, I think, you know, people are find their on-ramp different ways, but I think that's that pivot, right, you're talking.
And sometimes that comes later in life, because you may actually need to hit a certain level of financial independence before you're able to take that next step. And so I don't think it's shaming anyone to talk about that in the way we're talking about it, because we're not necessarily comparing someone else's journey to our journey, their point A to our point B, right? Everyone might be at a different spot on their journey, but the more they can learn about these things and understand that, the more that may be able to influence their future.
Right. But now, I mean, now I will shame them a little bit, right? Like, because now today, like, I don't go into traffic. I don't go into downtown very often. I try and avoid that kind of stuff, right? I travel. I go out and do my things when I want. But, you know, when I'm looking, when I'm driving around, I'm looking at the people. They're all kind of just going through autopilot, right? Just walking. And, you know, they're wearing their business clothes. And it probably took them damn near 30 minutes, an hour to put that get up on. Get in the car. Get in the bus. And they're just maybe on a break. And they got to go back in. They're building somebody else's dream in there. They're not, you know, yeah, they might like their job, but I don't know. I mean, I don't think your life starts until you kind of start working for yourself. You get yourself up to FI status or retired, and then you're able to kind of do what you want, who you want, how you want. I mean, it's very similar to like people who went to college for the first time, right? Not near your house, but they kind of went far away. It's like when you go there, you can do anything. I mean, some people do anything, right? And they get themselves into trouble. But when you finally wake up and you're financially free, you're kind of like, uh-oh, what do I do? And it's hard because most people at that age, 30 to 50 years old, I mean, it's kind of, you've been trained so long to think, hey, this is your life between these gutter alleys, and you can only do these things. You need to wake up at 8. You need to go in the car and drive to work every day.
I would say you've probably, fair to say, you've been conditioned since you were approximately 5 years old to have that type of mentality. When the school systems were originally put in the way they were put in, they were basically put in to train good factory workers. And so it's effectively what we all have been trained to do from the time we're in kindergarten until we're done university. And so to have that insight you had to say, wait a second, I don't want to go in and work for someone else from the time I wake up early in the morning till the end of the day, work long hours so that someone else can reap the rewards. You somewhat woke up from that system that you've been conditioned into. And luckily it started with that first single family home. So let's go back to there and say you had a realization, wait a second, I'm getting somewhere in the neighborhood of $600 a month into my jeans. Maybe I should do more of this. So take us on that path of how you started to continue to accumulate homes in the Seattle area.
Yeah. So I mean, just to kind of break down the numbers a little bit, and this is what I was doing when I was working on the road. And yeah, you're in first class in the airplane, but that gets super old after a while, you know, just sitting there. I mean, like when I break down the numbers, I was making like 30-something% of my money, and they weren't even that great of a rental, right? When you include the mortgage pay down, you know, your tenants paying down your mortgage, you're getting that equity buildup, just like you're paying off your own mortgage, getting that for free. You're getting that cash flow, right? That delta between all your income minus all your expenses, you're getting the tax benefits. And should the property appreciate, which typically real estate does, you're getting that at the leverage portion. So when you combine all that stuff.
Can I pause you on a second for that one?
Right,
because you just mentioned something that I think a lot of listeners don't realize about real estate. They think of the cash flow as the sole source of income on a property. And you mentioned two other key aspects. One, principal pay down. And the other, the long-term appraisal increase. So just thought it might be worth having a little bit of an expansion on those three things so that the listener can understand as we go through the conversation how those three things may differ as we talk single family, multifamily, primary markets, tertiary markets. And they start to think about the moving pieces and how you might trade one for another.
Well, I think tenants paying down your mortgage, right? They're making the PITA payment for you. And yeah, in the beginning of your amortization schedule, your interest is high. But a portion of that is your principal payment, which lowers how much you owe. So they're paying down your mortgage for you. So that essentially is money in your pocket. You can't tap it yet till you sell the asset or you do a refinance. but it's there, right? In addition to the obvious cash flow per month. And then, like you said, the property tends to appreciate. And remember, you're into this property leveraged with a great government-subsidized Fannie Mae Freddie Mac loan. So if the property property is going up with you putting oftentimes maybe 20% down to capture them, all the appreciation. It's like you're making a deal with the bank, but the bank gets none of the equity, the upside too. But the bank's putting up most of the money.
And is that typical leverage? Is that the typical leverage in the U.S.? You're sitting on around 20%.
Yeah, 80% loan to value. I mean, this is why, to me, America has some of the best rent to value ratios and the best loans. So it makes it very ideal to do this here in America. Whereas other countries, Canada, Europe, Asia, it's just the rent to value ratios aren't there, and comboed with the, you know, not lower leverage limits.
That's fair to say. I'm always, and we're going to dive into this when we start getting into some of your rules, but I look at the 1% rule and I think about where I live, and it's very challenging to even think about getting anywhere near the 1% rule, which we'll talk about later. If we go back, at this point, you've started to buy additional assets and you're starting to notice that there's a change in the cash flow attributes to those assets?
Yeah, well, I guess prior to that, I mean, when you add up all the ways you're making money, I mean, I wasn't that great about doing this back then. I was kind of a newbie, but I was making 30 something percent on my money every year. And, you know, people want to go into the numbers with me, they can go on my website or my YouTube channel, simplepassivecashflow.com/returns, where I do like a whiteboard example, break this down.
Great.
If you don't believe me, just go look it up. And so I was just sitting here and I'm like, why am I making 30 something percent on this dinky rental that I don't think is even that great? And why is my stock suddenly making 8 to 10% WTF, right? And as you kind of alluded to earlier, right, this is all a system, right?
That's right.
This is all like, the system, the school system. I mean, yeah, maybe it's a little bit of a bad outlook on the whole thing, but nevertheless, the system is engineered to keep this all working. And when you start to realize all these mutual fund companies, all these Wall Street companies, they're creating retail investments that most people start to invest in because the 401k unlocked it for them. Right now, the average man can go and buy, you know, paper assets. But I think what people don't realize is a lot of times, a good half to a third of their money is being taken away in hidden fees, right? Forget about that expense ratio being 0.01. That's not the fees. The fees are hidden, right? Again, how am I making 30% of my money when I'm really only getting 8 to 10% in a retail investment, right? How else do we have all these skyscrapers? How else do they have all these, you know, these Wall Street salaries? And that I became pissed off, right? Because that's not right. And that is how, you know, people, hardworking people like my parents who have doctorates and master's degree, they go to their place of work, work their ass off, and hopefully retire in 50 years, right? If, and kind of foreshadowing what we'll talk about here, I mean, how is it that somebody can just go buy a handful of rental properties and retire in less than a decade? You know, we can't have that happen. Because then nobody would work.
That's right.
Nobody would freaking do anything. Right? We can't have that happen. So you can see the reason why, the collusion of this whole system. Right? But yeah, that was the kind of the epiphany I came about. And I was like, I get it. I see how this world works. I'm just going to keep quietly buying more rental properties. And that's what I did. I bought a couple more units in Seattle. But this was around 2012. I started in 2009. 2012, I was going to buy another property. But this is where I just realized that sophisticated investors don't invest in primary markets like Seattle, California, Hawaii, New York, Boston, if they're investing for cash flow. Because you're just not going to find the rent-to-value ratios needed to give a cash flow. And the rent-to-value ratio is found by taking the monthly rent divided by the purchase price. So $100,000 house that rents for $1,000, that's 1%. And again, we're looking for something 1% or higher. So
1% or higher is the target for the rent-to-value ratio.
right? Because on that $1,000 rent house, you know, if each of my fingers is $100, you're going to have to pay the professional third party property manager, because we're not landlords here. We're investors. Let's let them do the dirty work and take on all that liability and headaches and tenants, termites, and toilets. You know, $100 is going to go to repairs. Things will break. Another $100 should go to some kind of slush fund that you save for CapEx breaks. Like, you're going to have to replace the roof every 20 years or so, some HVAC breaking. And then you got to pay your principal, interest, taxes, insurance. That's the other part. So the leftover, maybe a couple $100 out of that, is your cash flow.
Okay.
So this is where that 50% rule is. So like that rule is sort of a conservative, quick and dirty rule saying that take your monthly rent, just cut it in half. That is how much you should have left over to pay your principal, interest, taxes, insurance, your mortgage payment. That is your true cash flow. Just because your property rents for $1,000 and your mortgage is $500 doesn't mean you're cash flowing $500. But people, you know, people can go to my website and get my free analyzer, kind of play around with the numbers themselves and kind of get a good feel for it. I think it's at simplepassivecashflow.com/analyzer. But yeah, you got to know your numbers.
So we're going to dive into, you mentioned a couple key things right there, actually. Primary markets, the corollary where they do cash flow being tertiary markets. So can we start there and unpack that for people? Primary markets, you indicated California, New York, areas that you might call a metropolitan area.
Yeah, cool places to live, right? Or in other words, too much dumb money there.
Hawaii is an example.
Yeah, I live here in Hawaii, but I sure as heck don't buy out here.
And so when I watched some of your past material, you talked about secondary markets and you talked about tertiary markets. Can you describe what those are for people and why you choose the ones you choose?
Yeah, so secondary markets are kind of a shade under those primary markets in terms of population too. So, you know, these are still, I would say, 500,000 population kind of cities or couple million. They're big towns. These are places Birmingham, Atlanta, Indianapolis, Kansas City, Memphis, Little Rock. You know, these are large cities, but they're just not the sexy cool ones that attracts, you know, people paying stupid prices for it. And then that third tier is tertiary markets. So these are at least, we try to stay the cities that are above a 250,000 population. We want to be in towns or cities where it's a pretty diverse economy, as opposed to a little podunk town with just that one meatpacking plant. The meatpacking plant packs up and goes out of business, you're screwed.
Yeah, the whole town goes out of business with the single line of business that it had. One might look at Detroit, for example, where it only had, for a period of time, the automotive industry. And when that started to pack up, the values in Detroit dropped significantly.
Right. So Detroit would be an example of a secondary market, but maybe not the best economically diverse markets. I think it's a little bit different today, but back then, certainly it wasn't. Some of these tertiary markets might be like Huntsville, Alabama. I can't really think of too many off the top of my head, but Abilene, Texas, El Paso, Texas, places like that.
Gotcha. Okay. And so you tend to avoid more of those tertiary markets and focus on the bread and butter in the secondary markets.
Well, depends. I mean, we try and stay the secondary and tertiary markets, but this is when, you know, we're kind of going a layer deeper where more what is how good of a deal it is. And when we mean good of a deal, is how low are the rents today to what we can push it to in the future, or it's, we can fix it up to get it to it. And that's, for most passive investors or folks listening to here, that might be just minutia, right? But we fish in a pool of secondary and tertiary markets because for us, we want to at least be able to cash flow. But then, of course, we're fishing around 100,000 plus deals to find that one magical deal out there that has the great opportunity.
Rule number one, always cash flow from the beginning without any pro forma adjustment.
Right. So a lot of people think of real estate investing, this big world, and they think of like HGTV, house flipping stuff. That's very different than the world we live in. we're more buy and hold, cash flow first kind of guys. And, you know, that's, if you think about it, that these, the people who are betting on appreciation and weren't cash flowing on a month-to-month basis, these are the guys who always get hurt. You know, 2008, prime example of that. If you're cash flowing, in theory, you never have to sell. You always can just wait out till the time, you know, the market bounces right back up.
That's right.
We're effectively buying income streams. And I think this is the difference between traditional investing. Traditional investing dogma that everybody teaches you because they want your money, their funds, is the accumulation theory, right? Clint, save up $2 million or I don't know what it is today, $4 million, so you can live off of it in retirement and live off the rest and be happy, right? That is what we're all taught to do. But let's unpack it. To me, it's dumb because when you get to that stage in life, what do you need? You need to put food on the table and you need to pay your bills. So you need cash flow to do it, right? And so what most people do when they get to that age, they live off their pension or Social Security, which we're not going to have, but they're living off cash flow, right? So if they have $2 to $4 million of equities that have built up and appreciated to that point, they're going to need to convert that money to cash flow, right? Or just live off of it and eventually it goes to nothing. Maybe that's exactly what they want you to happen. But if you're smart about it, you create cash flow streams. But I employ, well, why don't we build cash flow streams today? After all, that's the end game, right? Why not begin with the end in mind and build cash flow streams today? So that's what we're doing here. We're building, whether it's a syndication deal or a rental property, you know, you're buying properties and cash flow for you, and you're creating multiple streams of income. So you're diversified. You don't have to worry about one stock market to go up. And the beautiful thing here is for most of my clients, they're able to, they, you know, these investments will kick off money, but they don't need it. They're working their day jobs. Their days are numbered, don't get me wrong. But these properties can keep kick off cash flow and have them acquire properties quicker and quicker. Like my first few properties, I mean, it was like watching grass grow. Yeah, I was really good at saving money, saving 50, almost 100 grand every year to buy one or two properties a year. But, you know, once you get a few of these properties in place, now I'm creating a third paycheck for myself. Exactly. And I can accelerate that acquisition and get even more cash flow. And this is effectively why the rich get richer, right? Because their assets create more money for them to buy more assets.
You're effectively getting to the point where your investments and your assets are creating, especially if you're in a relationship, your assets are adding a third income to the couple. So you, your partner, and now your investments are generating as much wealth as perhaps one of you is generating in your day job, which is an absolutely incredible spot to be.
This is nothing new, right? I mean, this is like Rich Dad, Poor Dad was essentially a copy of, you know, the richest person in Babylon.
That's right.
Right? Save 10% of your money to go buy assets, right? That make you more money. It
now,
takes
one of the
a while.
Problems with that is if you look at what you were doing when you were younger, you're saving far more than 10% of your money. When you're saving $50,000 to $100,000 after tax, that's a fair amount to be putting away to put into these investment properties. So when you start to talk to younger people, I would assume that a decent amount of that has to be not only how they make the investments, but how they reduce their expenditures. Maybe not all the way to what we were talking about earlier with lean fire, but at least a certain level of frugality to allow them to get started on this journey. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. And I think the nice thing about when you start to buy investments, right, you're like, all right, I used 30 grand to go buy this house, but that created, you know, a few hundred dollars in cash flow every month. And I see that every month. And that establishes that relationship where now you're motivated, right? I mean, I talk to a lot of families and their savings rate isn't that high. And I get it. I don't fault them for it, because why the hell would they want to save that money if it doesn't equate to anything on a That's monthly right. basis? Right? It's just like teaching. I think a lot of parents, they teach their kids about money, but I'm like, dude, you're just wasting. They don't care. They don't have any money. Well, why would they want to learn about this stuff, right? Yeah, I think that's that is like, it's a good motivator to get this stuff set up and they can see it working, right? As opposed to in a bank account making 0.01%.
Yeah. And I don't think, Lane, that many people talk to their children about money. And I know with our sons, I started talking with them about money at a very early age, even to the point of my oldest son going for a walk and talking about, you know, when he's at a college, if he goes there and he has his job. And I said, you know, would you rather, if you have $20,000, would you rather spend that and have fun with your friends? Or would you rather buy an apartment? He's like, well, what would happen with the apartment? And I explained the idea of leverage and said, now you're going to have more cash. And then in 2 or 3 years, you could buy another apartment. You can have that cash and you could eventually buy four. And he looked at me and he said, Dad, I'd rather buy apartments. And that was, you know, he was probably 10 years old at the time. And so I was trying to get him started on this journey earlier. So I'll have to get him to listen to this podcast when we're done so that while he's in high school, he starts to look to acquire properties. That'll be the goal.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's great you're talking to him like this, but I'll be honest. I mean, you know, he's probably still thinking Santa Claus brings his presents to him. And he's going to start to realize how hard it is to go buy a damn apartment. Right?
For sure.
And this is the steps that we're missing, right? Before I bought an apartment, I bought 11 single family homes. It took me 10 years, or it took me 6 years of doing this. And prior to that, I had to work for 2 years at a job I didn't like. And prior to that, I had to go to this like school in Seattle where it rained every single day and study my ass off when all the other poli-sci majors were out there playing frisbee, right? These were all steps to get to here. And what most people will do, they'll give up.
That's right.
They will never even get to that rental property part. And I think I've seen parents do what you do, and I don't think it works, right? You're missing all these intermediate steps. I mean, it's great intentions, right? But maybe another way of showing them would be, you know, like if I've kind of sat and watched some of my peers, they talk to their kids about, oh, you know, what do you want to do? You want to buy that thing? Cool. You can have anything you want, right? You want to buy something? All right. What's your plan to get that money? How much does it cost?
That's
what's your plan to get it?
Yeah.
Oh, you're going to go mow salons. All right. Well, you're trading your time for money. You and your uncle don't do that. Why don't you go find a way to make a business where you can have your friends mow the lawn for you, right? Those are the kind, you know, just those kind of get there's wheels turning. But I think the problem is, and this is adults, kids, millennials, baby boomers, nobody ever gets anything started. It's not a generational thing.
Nobody ever gets started. Take that. You talk about it. They don't take that first step. Sometimes I recognize, Lane, I may overgeneralize. A lot of people like to think about the end result. They don't like to think about the work that has to happen from today until that end result, and they don't take that first step. So a lot of what you talk about in your presentation is, what's that first step? And so for you, it was that single family home. You grew a number of them in Seattle. And then in 2012, you decided to go out of state. What drove that decision? We talked a little bit about it being cash flow, but what was your first step in going out of state?
Yeah. So yeah, first thing, the numbers didn't make sense in Seattle. I wasn't cash flowing in the beginning, and I finally realized it. And as prices were starting to come up, it made it super clear that I needed to kind of go elsewhere. I tried to do, you know, in any of endeavor, you try and search for the other thing. Right. So I also tried to go look at auctions, right? Because you hear a lot about, you know, buying distressed properties at cheap. But then they would have these like dinners where they would cater free spaghetti and they would get a bunch of investors around. And I went and I listened to the presentation, and it was kind of a war room setting where they would go look at the next properties. And I looked around the room and it's just a bunch of old, like dumb money. Bunch of guys who worked for Microsoft and didn't know what the heck they were doing. And that's when I realized I need to get out of this room, because this is where dumb money is and this is what I don't want to be doing. So you got to try something, right? So I tried. I took a Hail Mary and I was like, all right, I'm going to go buy one rental property. I'm not going to go visit it. It's not worth my time. See how it works. Got it, you know, found a few people to help me, a broker, a property manager, and tried it out, and it worked. Right? It's proof of concept.
So how did you find them?
I think I just started to just randomly network. I found other investors that were doing the same thing. And I built kind of loose relationships with those people, which is probably the best I could have done back then. Today, I rely heavily on my network. But you know, back then, when people were first starting, you weren't going to have that. So you're just going to kind of have to go on a limb. Hopefully, they're not getting paid for referring you to anybody and just more in it for the money. But I kind of followed the breadcrumbs and I found a broker. I found a property manager and kind of built the team up from there.
And that first one, if I'm not mistaken, was in Birmingham?
Yeah, it was. I think I bought it for like 60 or 70 grand and it rented for 850 a month. And this is a big culture shock for me, right? Like, I mean, I grew up in Hawaii, a primary market. I didn't know people lived in $100,000 houses. I didn't know that. But, you know, that's how most of America lives, right? Right? Like, we're the weird ones that lives in, you know, Vancouver, BC, Seattle, Los Angeles. We're crazy.
That's right.
Paying these prices.
And so at this point, you've now done Birmingham. Proof of concept. It worked. It's cash flowing. Life's great again. And you start to expand out. Atlanta, Indianapolis. How are you choosing these locations as you go?
I mean, you start to realize, you start to build a short list, right, of all these secondary markets with robust economies. And you kind of just refine the list with the people that you meet. Again, pure passive investors, not brokers trying to sell you deals because they're incentivized to have you buy. But yeah, you know, after a while, you gotta kind of just pick a few markets and build the team there. And that's what I did. My vision was to, you know, get a few cities to cluster around so I can concentrate my portfolio with, you know, a handful of property managers, maybe rise to the cream of the crop on their clientele list with maybe five. You know, I had five rentals in Atlanta with one guy and make it a little more scalable interacting with them. But that was, yeah, just kind of rinse, wash, repeat and keep buying cash flow at that point. And then around 2015, I had amassed 11 of these rental properties. Life was pretty good. I mean, I wasn't going to quit my job yet, right? Because with 11 rentals at a few hundred bucks of cash flow each, that's, you know, maybe $3,000, nothing to complain about.
Yeah.
But I don't know what American family can live off $3,000 of passive a month. I mean, most people have kind of that magic number of 10 grand passive a month.
That's right.
We're in a pretty good place. So just to give some people a little sense, like, I mean, we had property management company managing all the assets, but my job is to play asset manager. So when there's a big issue, they call me and ultimately they are the ones who takes over it. But it's my job to ensure that as the owner, they're doing it in a cost effective and timely manner.
Mm-hmm.
So just to give a little bit, I mean, 11 properties is a great sample size. I had maybe an eviction or two every year, some kind of big catastrophe that happened every quarter, like tree fell in the house or plumbing leak or something like that. No big deal. But
No big deal, but those plumbing leaks always seem to happen.
Yeah. I mean, it's like clockwork, right? I mean, it's, you have 10 kids, guarantee one or two of them is going to go to jail, right, at some point. Like, it's just a matter of happening. But yeah, I mean, to get to that magic number of 10 grand passive a month, I need 30 of these properties. And then now you're like, whoa, 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 whoa. Now you're like, times that by three, an eviction every other month, and some kind of big catastrophe every other week. And you're just like, whoa, this is, I have to search and pivot for the next thing. And that's what I did. I started to look into apartments. I didn't know it was apartments, but that's where I went first. And I was just kind of searching because this obviously wasn't scalable to be the king of single family home investor, you know, lane. And this is where I stumbled upon the power of the network. I started to join different mastermind groups, paid ones, because that's really the only good ones. You know, things that are cheap, easy, free really never pan out. They're usually just a waste of time. So I started to get around high net worth, accredited investors, a lot of doctors, lawyers, engineers that were financially free and a little bit older than myself. And I started to listen, right? And it was finally, I got around a group of people who were on the path and financially free, which is very different from what you'll find in your daily life, what your neighbor is doing, what your coworker is doing. Don't take any financial advice from anybody who's not financially free. It might even be a CPA or a lawyer. That's why they still got their suckers with jobs, you know?
Yeah, I want to dive into this because I thought this was very, very important. So this is 2016 now. You're making good money in a day job. You have 11 single family homes that you're renting out, and you decide to make a very significant investment. I believe I saw it was in the neighborhood of $60,000. And the investment is in the most important thing you can invest in, which is yourself. So you have your mastermind groups, you have your paid learning. What are some of the greatest things you learned when you were doing that?
I'll be honest, the education wasn't really that great. Just a bunch of dinky videos. But the more important thing is it got me in the room with the right peers. And something can be said for spending money on it and you following through, right? Because now you're the idiot who spent all this money on it and just that go to waste. Right? I was committed to kind of follow through and do it. So before I put down any money, I was kind of like, well, maybe I'll just be the guy with 30 or 50 houses. But boy, am I glad I did it, because I found this world of pure passive investing and syndications and private placements. And I realized that high net worth accredited investors invest in these types of opportunities where they're passive LP investors. But then it also opened up another world of all these cool tax strategies they do. Like, you know, a lot of these big deals, they'll do cost segregations to extract way, way more tax benefits and get these passive activity losses, which they in turn, you know, lower their ordinary income via a real estate professional status designation under taxes and to pay little to no taxes, which creates the happy cycle even more, and then to invest more, to make more money, and then also employ different tax and legal strategies and infinite banking. And this is where I uncovered the secrets of the wealthy. Like, a lot of these things, they're kind of simple, right? Like simple passive cash flow. It's very simple. But who does this stuff, right? Who doesn't buy their house to live in, right? Who doesn't do retirement? Well, none of these people are doing it. But all those rich, those poor suckers out there working day jobs, they're all doing these retirement funds, all this crazy stuff that I think it's crazy.
But yeah, it's simple. The problem is it's a get rich slowly method that people aren't attracted to. It takes a fair amount of sacrifice to save up those down payments and to get that ball rolling, if you will. Once you have the snowball going, which you did very young, it puts you on a path that it doesn't seem like a lot of people can get into. Am I wrong on that?
I was very lucky, right? Like I had money very young, and I didn't have any skeptic spouse that really had a clingy affinity towards me, living in a house that they won't, you know, that's $600,000, $1 million. So this was able, that was kind of my advantage to kind of get that lift off the ground. I mean, in fact, I didn't mention this, but you know, after I had bought that first rental property, I was like, wow, this is my ticket out of this rat race so I can fire my boss. So I actually, because I was working on the road all the time, I actually just, you know, I moved out. I didn't live anywhere. I didn't have a mortgage or rent payment to pay. I just lived on company expenses for, I think, several years. So that was how I was able to save, you know, six figures every year by just being a rambling man, you know?
And you rent in Hawaii right now, don't you?
Yeah, I don't really believe in buying. I mean, maybe when my net worth is $10 million, I'll buy a house to live in. But to me, it makes no sense.
So along that way, have you at any point lived in a home you owned? Or have you just rented in primary markets where the loan-to-value ratios are low, and then have your investments that you own in high rent-to-value ratio markets?
I've owned a couple of houses to live in, but I don't do that today.
Okay.
And another big thing that separates the wealthy from the average is their viewpoint on debt, right? Like we go into a lot of good debt, right? And good debt is defined as you're picking up an asset that puts more money, a lot more money than what the debt service is. And this is something most people are very scared of. Right. This is the antichrist for a lot of people.
Yes.
Going into any kind of debt for them. To me, debt's a tool. You can use a tool for good and bad.
If used properly. And it's, you're absolutely accurate when we were talking about financial independence community earlier. Generally, they refer to any form of debt as a sin, as evil. And you or I would look at it and say, well, whoa, there are different types of debt. If you're carrying credit card debt to buy a TV or a couch, that's bad debt. If you have credit card debt at 0% interest and you used it to buy a home, that could be a really good debt. So knowing the difference between positive debt and negative debt, debt that will have you effectively in the rat race longer versus debt that will allow you a path out of that rat race.
And like a lot of my clients will have this mindset of like, well, we're trying to pay down our house. I tell them, well, you know, we don't do that because we want to take that lazy equity, not doing anything in your home, and possibly go five or six apartment buildings for you, right? To in turn play this arbitrage game where we're making a lot more money. And it just comes down to their comfort zone and education, right? To make those decisions that ultimately is going to lead them into a better place. There's a strategy out there where you take your home equity via a HELOC and you pay down your mortgage. I think it works, but I wouldn't do it. I would rather take the money and buy investments. At the end of the day, you're going to grow your net worth faster. And that's what it all comes down to. How does your net worth growing? Being debt-free is not aligned with financial freedom. Another mistake a lot of people make a lot of times is that, well, you know, like let's go back to the buying a house thing, right? Like, I think most people should buy their house. People are like, wait a minute, what is he saying? He's just saying not buying a house, but a house is a forced savings account. And most people in this world are really bad with their money. They get $500, they go and blow it. So for those people, most people, they should go buy a house because it prevents them from getting their grubby hands on their money. And they have to pay their mortgage first, usually. But for some of us who are good with their money, take the money and go buy investments. And with the cash flow you get, you're probably good enough to not go just spend it, blow it on something silly.
That's right. You just said something and you mentioned it in one of your videos and it really resonated with me. And it was at that stage when you started to go into multifamily. You said, if you are able to save more than $30,000 a year or have substantial liquidity, being a landlord, and especially flipping, is not scalable. It is merely a form of capital appreciation. So at the time that you said that, was that when you were making your transition from single family homes where you realized, I can't scale this? And part of that may have been, Lane, your point about an eviction every quarter was becoming an eviction every month, and you needed to move to something that could scale. Is that when you made the jump to multifamily?
Yeah, that was kind of was when I was kind of making that jump. And I think very similar to, like, you know, some people go to the MBA, right, from college. And they don't go to over college, right, back in the day. You know, when you do that, right, there's not really a flow chart for people. It's kind of like based on the person, right, and their talent level. And it's the same thing here. When does an investor that, you know, books an onboarding call with me, when do we put them to a turnkey remote rental? When do we say, well, maybe you should start to look at these private placements as a passive investor? Certainly, if you're an accredited investor, I think it's a no-brainer. Don't screw around with all these rental properties. It's a pain in the ass, right? But for, you know, look how I started. I didn't have any money. I learned a lot by getting rental property from the bat. And I certainly don't think people under a quarter, maybe even $500,000 should do syndication, because most syndications, private placements, are $50,000 minimum investments. That's a huge chunk of change for somebody who's $250,000. And overall, my general advice to people is never to go into any one deal with more than 5 or 10% of their net worth. $50,000 to someone who's $250,000, that's 20-25% or something like that. It's too much.
That's a really good point, and we'll definitely come to that because I wanted to have some questions around getting into syndications and understanding it from both sides. One of the things that you talk about when you're considering where on the spectrum between active versus passive, and you chose passive, and we'll get into the reasons you chose passive, but you highlight four different things. You talk time, money, knowledge, and network. Can you unpack that a little for the listener?
Yeah. So when I have my onboarding calls, like, I don't know anything about anybody. I'm kind of asking specific questions to figure out where they fall in those four attributes: time, money, knowledge, network. Knowledge and network are kind of intertwined a little bit, but you know, the major ones are: how much money does this dude have? How much time does he have? Does he have a super busy day job? Yeah, that kind of dictates where we place him. I think in the active passive spectrum, you know, like most of the active investing is wholesaling, flipping houses. I don't really advocate for any of that type of stuff. Most of people in my community, their highest and best use is at their day job. So they shouldn't waste their time flipping houses or wholesaling. And it's not good tax advantage anyway. But in this world that I live in of, you know, turnkey rentals or syndications, you have semi-active and you have passive. Right? So when we're talking like that, you know, using those three attributes, you know, first money, right? That's probably the easiest one because it's a numerical thing. If a guy doesn't have very much money, it's simple. Buy a rental property, get yourself educated, dude. You know, come back in 5 years.
Start with the basics.
Right, right. Because the thing about syndications is anybody can put together a syndication and bring in passive investors. So if you're a new passive investor, you don't have a shot determining if this is a good deal or not. All these people putting together these deals, trying to find investors, they all have really polished pitch decks. You can go on Upwork and get one done for $50, right? You can do a webinar, right? Everybody has a podcast today. Everybody has a book these days. You know, this is real estate. It's a marketing business. Everybody makes themselves look really good. So if you don't have any basis in reality, you have not owned rental property, or you don't have a good network, a peer group around you to help you to determine if this is a good investment for you, I think that's kind of dangerous.
So learn from the turnkey rentals yourself so that when you ultimately do assess whether you want to invest in a syndicated deal down the road, you at least understand the basics.
Right, right. But it's not necessary. Not necessary. I mean, and it may not be the right way of going about it, because the second big thing is, how much time does this person have, right?
That's right.
Is this person to buy a rental property, even a turnkey one? I mean, it's going to take you at least 6 months of like work, putting in 4 hours a week just to learn some stuff. I mean, I think that's why people join our little incubator group, because it greatly decreases the time, the learning curve. Right, but you're paying money for that, right? But if you were to do it yourself, I mean, you're talking 4 hours a week for 6 months. They kind of get yourself up to a point where you're prudently, you know, placing $30,000 to buy a $100,000 house. I think any less than that would be irresponsible, just kind of putting up a prayer. But, you know, like if somebody, you know, had a handful of kids, they're already super, you know, they're working 50, 60 hours a week, it probably would probably be better just to kind of take that chance and be a syndication investor potentially. I would still advocate for them to try get as far along the road of buying a rental property, because trying to do that, they would learn type of stuff, right? It wouldn't be like, oh, you know, you learn, go 4 years to college, you don't get the degree, it was a waste of time. No, this is all like helpful, right?
Can you explain to the listener what a turnkey rental is, just for those who might not know?
Yeah, so turnkey rental means a lot of different things. But, you know, ideally what it is there's a house flipper out there that picks up a distressed property and fixes up all the major components, the electrical, the plumbing, the new HVAC, new paint, puts in like hardware that's heavy duty, right? Better floors are more durable. Maybe they're not the nicest. You know, we're not talking stainless steel here, but it's good rental grade type of stuff. And sometimes they'll even put a tenant in there for you, and sometimes even manage it for you. So it'll be a true turnkey experience. But essentially what I mean turnkey, it's, you know, it's a good bones, right? Got a good property. And maybe I usually advocate for my students to go find a third party property manager and have them put a person in there for you at that point. So they can kind of take the reins from the builder or the house owner.
And so effectively you can turn the key, open the door, and it's ready to go.
Yeah. And it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like a rental property with training wheels.
There you go.
You're paying a little bit extra for it, right? You're definitely paying retail price, but I think even paying retail price, you're still doing 2 or 3 times better than what you'd probably be getting in the stock market.
So can you tell the listeners how a syndicated deal works from the syndicator's perspective and from the investor's perspective?
Yeah, so the syndicator's perspective, the syndicator is more of an experienced investor. They've been around the block. Ideally, you want to find a syndicator that this is their full-time day job. They're a professional, right? They're not some IT worker doing this on the side, right? Trying to find something that allows them to quit their day job, right? Like, they are professionals and they have networks and relationships in place with brokers or property sources to find the best deals out there. So, I mean, probably go through like several hundred to 1,000 to find that one deal that makes sense. So they're going out, they're finding the deal. They're even putting the debt in their own name. So none of it goes into the passive investor's name. And these lead sponsors, syndicators, operators, what they call them, all different words, but means sort of the same thing. They're going out and they're kind of putting a business plan together. Maybe they're doing a little bit of rehab to bump the rents up $100, you know. And then ultimately, then they have to go and come up with the CapEx money and down payment money and cash reserves, which they raise from passive investors. And that's the point where the passive investors come in. And the analogy I like to use is like an airplane. You know, in the cockpit, you have the general partners, which is that person flying around the deals. And this can be a team of people also. And oftentimes it is sort of a team sport, but the passive investors come in the plane, normally $50,000 minimum, and they board the plane and they go to sleep. And the nice thing with this analogy, you know, they're all aligned, right? If the general partners crash the plane, well, they die too, right? In this figurative example.
And when you're looking at the general partner, is there usually a promote built into the structure?
That's correct. They're not doing it for free. Nobody does anything for free, nor would you want them to.
That's right.
There's usually some kind of fee structure, some kind of acquisition fee or asset management fee, and or a carried interest. So, for example, it might be like they take 20% of all the profits, right, where the passive investors get 80. And this is where there's no one split that is average, right? I mean, it ranges. And this is the private placement world. It's sort of the Wild Wild West.
And would you almost describe that as similar to a hedge fund with a 2 and 20? So
very similar.
Okay.
Very, very similar. But I think, you know, if a deal is fatter than normal, I would assume that the general partner would ratchet up their splits, which from an LP's perspective, that's awesome, right? Let the general partner find a great deal. Let him get rewarded. Maybe he gives us a little bit too, but it's economics, right? Because passive investors, there's always a number that they want to see based on a certain perceived risk reward profile on a deal. Yeah. Like on a development deal where they're building something from scratch, they may want to double their money in 3 years. Right? Whereas a more stabilized asset, they may want to double their money in 5. Right? And some investors are really unsophisticated. They may not know what they're what's average, right, in the marketplace. I mean, a lot of these deals are kind of found on crowdfunding websites, but to me, the reason why the operator goes to the crowdfunding website is because they can't raise the capital on their own based on their own investors. And that, to me, is a red flag. I personally want to know my sponsor.
That's right. And so when you talk the average investor, what would you say the average investor in a syndicate deal is targeting from a limited partner investment perspective?
Yeah, like I said, like, you know, if it's a development deal where they've got to wait a couple, 2-3 years for cash flow, maybe they're looking at when the asset is sold to double their money in 3 years.
So 24%?
100% return in 3 years. So, you know, 30-something percent. Whereas, you know, more stabilized asset that's kicking off cash flow, even from the get-go, with some light value adds. So you know, maybe just bumping the rents up $50, $100. Maybe they'd be looking to double their money in 5 years. So a little under 20% a year. Not bad, right? I mean, when you're also getting the passive losses and playing, you know, games on your taxes and stuff too.
Okay, Lane, where are you excited about right now? When you start to look at markets, what markets are you thinking are the next spot to go after?
Yeah, I mean, one of the rules that we follow are we kind of go to red states. So not to say anything politically, but we want to be in states where the landlord laws are on our side as landlords. And typically red states tend to be a little bit more economic focused, right? I mean, you look at the people moving out of California into states like Texas, right? You know, my top 5-6 markets are like Phoenix, Arizona, all of Texas, Alabama, Georgia, the Carolinas, Florida. And those are, and they're all generally, they follow the trend of the southern states, the warmer climates. That's where all the population growth is going, and that's where all the economic development is essentially going. So that's what we're going.
So that aligns with something I'd heard you say in the past, was that growth is tilting heavily to the south. Why do you think that is?
You know, I think maybe part of it is like, you know, with an aging population, people are moving to the warmer climates from the north, east, north. I don't know. I frankly don't care, right? Like, it's, I just follow data. Right? The data is telling me. The manufacturing is coming back online. I don't really know what leads the other, like economic growth or population growth. Me, I'm just trying to kind of go where the puck is going.
Something I saw that you look to that was really interesting, and I'll get you to explain why to the listener, is you look at what's called the U-Haul Bandline Report to see where, I think you said it was, where are the blue-collar workers migrating to?
Yeah, so we kind of focus on workforce housing. So, you know, our rentals are like $700 to $1,200. We stay away from the luxury high end because the theory is in tough times, you know, people who live in their yuppie condos, they have to move down to the more B-class value-based apartments, which is primary our portfolio. We also are not in the low end, the slumlord area sector. We're kind of in that middle, right? Good value housing, especially in a country where population growth is increasing and there's just a growing demand for workforce housing, good quality housing. Yeah, that's why we invest in this type of stuff. And through the pandemic, right, like I think it showed its strength. Normally we collect 97% of our rents. So out of 100 people, you have a few deadbeats, but to be expected. But yeah, through COVID, in April, May of 2020, maybe it dipped on average down to the mid-90s.
Which isn't too bad.
Yeah, I mean, we're still making money if we stay above like 60-something percent.
And so I think I've seen you talk about when you grade buildings A, B, C, and D. Can you give the listeners a quick description of how you would differentiate between those four? And what I think I heard was when the market's moving up, people who are in a D building may move to a C, C's move to a B, B's may move to an A. And in a recession, your A's go back to a B, go back to a C, C's to a D, which means if you're always in that B and C grade building, in an up market, you should have people. And in a down market, you're somewhat recession proofing yourself because your A's will come down to your B and C buildings. So can you tell the listener about those B and C and A and D buildings?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, we're trying to stay in the middle of the bell curve. But yeah, like we have different grading systems for not only the class of the property, but also the neighborhood and tenant profile. So easiest one to define is the class of the building. And that's usually dictated by the age. You got a generally like a 1980s property is more of a B class, 1960s starts to get to the C. Yeah, I think it helps once investors come on our tours and we kind of point it out what it is. That one's simple. The one that is harder for people to grasp is the tenant profile and the location grade. So A class is, you know, nice, right? It's where
we all want to live there.
We all want to live there. Class B is a mixture of white and blue collar. It's generally safe. You maybe don't want to run around at nighttime. And then Class C is rougher. You may want to kind of, whatever you're doing, get in, get out during the daytime. Class D and F are more war zone type of properties. You don't buy stuff in those kind of areas. But, you know, I mean, not to be sexist or anything like that, but a young female can go running or jogging at nighttime in an A class. She might be able to only do that in the B class neighborhood during the daytime. She probably shouldn't hang out in a Class C area, you know.
It's a good way to understand it. And so would it be fair to say you're targeting B and C buildings in A and B neighborhoods?
Yeah, because we can't do anything about the buildings. And most times our business plan is to improve the building, right? So we're trying to make it better, but we can't really do much with the location. You know, in some of our 300 unit apartments, we have a little more flexibility to change the complexion of the community, but for the most part, the location is, it is what it is.
And can we talk a little bit about, because I think one of the fundamental concepts with being a landlord is understanding how pennies can become dollars when you look at cap rates. And so when you talk about improving the buildings and how small changes that may not seem large become massive when you think about the cap rate effect, and when you think about the leverage effect. So can you maybe educate the listener on how cap rates work and how we use cap rates income properties, and then how that even compounds further when you look at the leverage aspect of it?
Yeah, so you know, like I think when people buy houses, you know, single family homes, anything under four units, it's evaluated on the comparable sales. What are the properties sell for around that subject property? Which is subjective and emotional, and why I don't like it. Because it goes up and down. Commercial properties contrast by its the price is evaluated by the net operating income approach. So if you can control your net operating income, you can effectively change the price of your property, the market price. The net operating income, which we refer to as NOI, is, you know, your income, which is basically your rents minus all your expenses. So you have two levers there. You know, if you increase the rents or it decreases, you can play around with the NOI. Or if you increase expenses or decrease your expenses, you can change it. So most times what we're doing is we're increasing the income by making our property better, but also increasing amenities. So our expenses are increasing also, but our income is greatly increasing. So when we buy a property at this sort of NOI level and this, we change it to this, something higher, we kind of take that delta, and that's how much we effectively force appreciated that asset, which has nothing to do with market appreciation.
Yeah, so I'll use some numbers just for people who aren't watching a video, and we'll use a simple example. When we buy it, revenue is $100 and expenses are $50. So our net operating income is $50. If we're able to grow both the revenue and the expenses by 5%, revenue goes to $105. Expenses only go to $52.50. So we've actually created $250 of additional NOI. So as long as we can keep that ratio the same between the revenues and expenses, we're creating incremental net operating income.
So let me use like a simple example. Like, you know, let's just say we have a 100 unit building, which I think is a small property, but 100 is easy for us math, especially in podcast form. But, you know, on that 100 unit building, say there's 20 reserved parking spaces out in the front, right? Parking is a little sparse. So let's just charge almost 20 parking spaces. Let's just charge $20 a month. Seems reasonable, right? So we created $400 of extra NOI per month. And, you know, this is based on a year.
Because when we bought the building, they weren't charging for parking. And we said, well, why wouldn't we charge the tenants for the parking spot?
Right. So we created $4,800 of extra NOI per year. Let's just assume that these certain assets are trading at a 5 cap. So divided by 0.05. So we just made $96,000 for us just by making that one management decision.
Okay, so can you explain to the listener what the concept of a cap rate is?
So the cap rate is sort of like a multiplier, right? Maybe if I explain it, like, say you have a business, right?
That's right.
And if people are familiar with the term EBITDA, but you have a certain profit you're making. And just like in businesses and in apartment investing, real estate investing, there's a certain multiplier you apply to it to determine the price. And that is effectively the cap rate in the real estate world is effectively that multiplier.
And another way, said differently for someone who may want a simple way to look at it, is what we're effectively doing is we're taking that income stream that is coming out of the rental property and we're treating it as a bond, if you will. So if we had a bond and we wanted a 5% return, we would expect a certain amount of income to flow from it. So to do that, we take the income that we're getting from that property and we divide it by that bond rate, and it tells us what the value of the asset is to give us our desired return level. So when we're talking a 5% cap rate, we're effectively saying that if we pay that price for the asset, we'll generate a return to our bottom line, being the net, the NOI that Lane's talking about, of 5%, which also means for every dollar that we increase NOI, when you divide it by that 5%, that dollar is worth $20 in asset value.
And this is how you're able to double investors' money in a pretty relatively short period of time. And this is how, this is not just waiting for the trade winds to blow or AKA market appreciation. We are creating value here. And the value that we're creating is better living conditions for our tenants, who in turn pay more money for that. This isn't a buy low, sell high kind of thing. We are taking our own fate in our own hands, force appreciating this asset and creating value, and then extracting that value via refinance or just selling the asset. And this is how we make money. This is not a tricks and game, buy something on Amazon for this price, sell it for this. Like, no, we are truly adding value. And I think this is a fundamental difference that I see a lot of people not understanding, is for people who really create wealth for themselves, it's because they created value, not some game.
Absolutely, Lane. I love it. Thank you very much. I'd like to now just maybe pivot to a few questions that I like to ask all of my guests that are a little bit different than real estate. We've focused up till now on a lot of positive things that have happened on your journey. Can you tell us about a time that you failed, but it was a great lesson for you?
Yeah, I've actually made this mistake a couple of times, investing with the wrong person.
Okay.
These syndication deals are great until you invest with the wrong person. It's kind of like going to the on the roulette wheel, hitting that double diamond, and the house just takes your money, right? The lesson learned is now I have a sort of a process, and I kind of call this the gold standard of investing. You're not going to know all the people you're working with at first, but my ideal is I don't invest with anybody or partner with anybody unless I have somebody that I truly trust, which is an pre-existing organic relationship that has invested with them in the past. Can kind of sign off and co-sign on their validity track record, right? Because before, I just, who do you know? Oh, I know Bob, right? Bob's cool. All right, let me go invest in Bob, right? But that's not the gold standard. The gold standard is, friend that I knew a long time, that I trust, that doesn't have any dog in the fight or any getting any referral fee. Do you have $50,000 with this gentleman? Oh, you don't? Well, how the heck do you know that?
Using the degrees of separation to say, I may not know Ted, but I know Ellen, and Ellen is someone I trust, and she's invested $50,000 with Ted multiple times, so I can trust Ted.
Right.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. What is something that you struggle with or are challenged by on a day-to-day basis?
I'm just probably just trying to get everything done in the day, just like anybody else. Right. But that's been my case since the beginning of time. And I'm sure everybody deals with that. Right. But I do notice, these days, I would waste a lot of time. If you would have found me 5 years ago, I would waste a lot of time doing a lot of silly things, playing around my net worth spreadsheet. That's a waste of time.
forecasting it out 10 to 20 years and
yeah,
seeing
like,
where you'll end up. Well, just go make yourself end up there. Don't spend all the time thinking about it.
I would spend a lot of time doing that. Maybe a couple hours every weekend doing something, screwing around with speech spreadsheets. Today is different. I just got a Google Keep and that's how much money was going in this month. And these are some big bills I'm expecting. It's done. Simple. I'm actually doing the creating. Hopefully I'm creating value, right? That's where I'm kind of turning my money into. Is this value add? Do I really need to be doing this?
I love where you are at 35 years old and you're still feeling like you've wasted a lot of your time along the way. That's pretty incredible.
See where it goes.
So flip the coin. What is something that comes easy to you that other people struggle with?
I think I execute. I am more on the side of, you know, getting things done than being perfectionist, which allows projects to move forward, especially if I have the right people around me, the teammates, to get it, the things that I'm not equipped to do done. I think that is something that has contributed to my success. I'm good enough for government work, right, for some things.
I think not enough people realize the importance of just starting. And so you talked a bit about this earlier, and I've seen you talk about it in some of your videos, is if you're waiting for perfection, you're never going to start. Sometimes you need to just start and figure it out along the way. So it's excellent that you've been able to do that throughout your career.
I mean, most people are just, it's just subconsciously procrastinating because they don't want to step up to bat. They don't want to take action because they could fail. It's like, yeah, you could fail. But you know, when you're investing for cash, it'll help back in a beat. Right?
And if you never start, you always fail.
Right.
So last question for me is, when you are operating at your absolute best, what habits, routines, or practices are you following on a daily basis, weekly basis, monthly basis, etc.?
I think I'm just kind of working down my list of things I need to do. It's a little chaotic, but I think I subscribe to the theory that successful people are able to ratchet up intensity, and maybe they don't work that long. Maybe they do. I mean, I work 10, 12 hours a day, but the key is I'm able to hold on to a level of intensity that gets things over the finish line, multiple things.
And there's something key there. How do you hold that level of intensity on an ongoing basis while maintaining your health and sanity?
I mean, I work out a lot. I do CrossFit. It's short. It's quick. I try and get my 7-8 hours of sleep. Try and eat well. Work out. I think that the health is a big part of it, because if you're not able to function, you're not going to be able to physically hit that mental intensity level that you're going to need to get things done.
What do you do to maintain your mental health? Are there any practices that you do there?
I don't know. I probably should get better at this, you know? I mean, that's the danger, right, of like high intensity people, is they burn out.
That's right. That's right.
I don't know. I mean, just try and sleep, you know, try not to get kooky, try to work out, try to eat good things, right?
Yeah. You just listed a lot of things that, you know, you necessarily may not have thought about when I first asked the question, but you said you eat well, you exercise, you sleep 7 to 8 hours a night. Right there, you're probably doing three things at the 80% of the population doesn't do. So those may be some keys to helping you continue to operate at such a high intensity.
Well, it's just simple, right? I mean, the simple things. It's not like one thing that I have like a float tank in my house or something like that, right? It's the basics. I mean, I try not to operate at 99% all the time, right?
Absolutely. As a CrossFitter, you probably have heard of Matt Frazier.
Yeah. Yeah, Hardwick pays off.
Yeah, and I heard Matt on a podcast, and he said a lot of people ask him, because you may not remember that when he originally started competing in the CrossFit Games, he was doing a double major in engineering and business at the same time, and he was still on the podium. And when they asked him how he did that, he said, it's simple. It's really, really simple. It isn't easy, but it's simple. I take everything in life that isn't contributing to my goals, and I cut it the F out.
Yeah, that's exact. Actually, that is, I don't think it was him. It might have been Dave Cashflow, but I think that's where I got the term simple from, simple passive cash flow. That's where I came up with that term. It actually was that Greg Glassman guy who people don't like anymore. But
yeah, he's gone.
he had the quote. Well, we'll turn it into the Matt Frazier quote, but it was the same quote. It was, things aren't easy, but they're very simple. Simple Faster Cash. I'm sure I had a t-shirt like that, but yeah.
So is there anything at this point that we've missed that you want to dive into a little bit deeper?
No, I mean, I guess, what do you think about the barriers? I mean, we've laid out a path for people that is proven, and yet it might take some time. But what do you think are the barriers that people aren't just going to get that? You know, people listen to podcasts. It's notorious. I don't listen to podcasts these days, but I see a lot of people, they listen and they get this warm and fuzzy feeling, and they appease that need for growth. But they don't do anything.
Yeah, I'd say there's a number of things that are there. And that's a really great one to unpack, is a lot of what I've seen from the people that I'm close to is, one, I don't think they believe the numbers until they actually do it, right? So you can share your numbers. They may think that you're just making it up. I've been on the same path as you for probably the last 10 years. And so I absolutely agree with your numbers. I'm seeing them in action. I understand them. And outside of my own personal investing, I'm for the last decade, I've worked in real estate development. So I fundamentally understand the path you're taking and believe it. Number two is, the average person seems to not take the steps needed to achieve. In Lane, I generally break that down into three things. Know what you want. Know what it takes to get it. Have a plan. Be willing to do what it takes. And so you've laid out something that to me and to you is simple, but it's not easy. And I think a lot of people out there, one, they don't necessarily know what they want. Two, they don't necessarily know how to achieve it, nor are they willing to do the work to figure that out, which takes you to step three. If you're not willing to do the work to figure out how to do it, then you're probably not going to do the work that's needed to get it done. And so when you look at real estate investing and you look at the path you took, which I find extremely impressive, you were saving a large portion of your income. So when you think back on those frugal hacks and you say, it may have felt a little embarrassing at the time, it is absolutely, to me, not embarrassing. It is fundamentally a key to how you achieved what you did at a young age. And I think a lot of people aren't willing to live without, because they see other people spending their money and living that lifestyle. They see social media and they're not willing to do without so that they can do more in the future. And so those are a few of the fundamental reasons that jump out to me. And then, no, I'd say the last one is they look at friends on social media. They look at, you know, we always call it the Joneses, keeping up with the person next door who has a nice car. You know, they may not realize that that person's in debt to buy that car. Like when my kids come home and tell me that a kid at school's rich, I ask them how they know that kid's rich. And they talk about possessions. So I started teaching them at a young age that possessions are nothing. It's, what is that person's net worth? How much debt do they have? Are they really rich, or is their dad not sleeping at night because he has a ginormous mortgage that he has to pay down, and it's not to have cash flow generating assets? So those are the major reasons for me. One, I think you're right. It's simple, but it's not easy. Two, people aren't willing to do the work that's needed to get there. And three, what you're talking about takes money. And a lot of people want to spend their money on keeping up with the Joneses instead of investing in their own future. That's my take. And that may be very, very cynical. What do you think the barriers are?
I think one thing that people could look at the situation and be like, wow, like, you know, I can't save 50 or 100 grand a year, right? I have a family, you know, that may be already used to a high level of standard living. And so my message to them is like, well, that doesn't matter. You know, if you can save 5-10 grand, that's a start, right? You know, like, we got to get you on the escalator to buy a rental property. You know, that's $30,000 of liquidity that you need. You don't need to be like me, right? You don't need to be 7 feet tall and dunk a basketball to do this. It just might take a little more time, that's for sure. But anybody can do it. And we're not asking people to go out and go buy 4,200 units this next year, right? It might just be buy a rental property this year or the next 3 years, right? And we're not asking you to withdraw all your retirement funds, right? Let's get proof of concept, right? And I think that's when I look into the eyes of people, and they'll never tell me what the real reason is, because we're adults and we always have layers to our onion and we never reveal what's the true meaning. I try and like create the goal like very attainable and kind of keep it moderate. But at the end of the day, it's people just are unable to get out of their comfort zones, right? But if I can kind of lower that barrier to like, hey, you know, we're just trying to buy one, right? Just trying to see if it's going to work, mm-hmm. right? I think that's how, that's ultimately like my job these days is not really, I mean, all the strategies are kind of simple, but how do I get people on the path? How do I get them on the on-ramp, the highway?
That's like, a great point.
It's like diet and exercise, right? I mean, I think diet exercise is a great on-ramp to kind of learning about these same habit changers, right? Or life changers. Like we got Albert here, right? You know, we're not going to have him go do a trail run every single day, right? We're going to start small. Right? And it's going to take him a while to get to his goals. But, you know, if we be dogmatic about it, he's not us. He may not be able to have that intensity on 99% of the time. He doesn't sleep, right? Likes to screw around on YouTube too much. But how do we get them that initial proof of concept to get them to kind of just keep kick the can down the road and getting moving in the right direction? That's kind of where I kind of struggle with most people, or that's where I kind of focus on. If people are, there's two people in this world, like people who are willing to kind of just make small progress and large progress too. But then there's people who are unwilling because they have some kind of limiting belief that they think that that's not for them or it's all fake, right? But really it's potentially somebody who, yeah, maybe they've fallen for a scam before, right? This kind of stuff does sound a little bit too good to be true, I get it. But maybe they just don't think that this is for them because they were told that they have to go to school and work at that job for 40, 50 years. I mean, that's what their thing is. I don't know.
That one you said right there. So if we think about the average person, we talked about earlier that from the time we're in kindergarten till we get out of college, we're basically stuck in that same program, which teaches you 9 to 5. And so all of a sudden you're saying, hey, there's a path out of that. Now you're one person who's explaining something to them that's completely different than what they've known their entire life. And so it's probably easier to believe that you're the exception to the rule versus something that they can do.
But it's hard. I mean, that's why I do events with people, and people are very different than, you know, it's like a club of financial friends and we geek out on this stuff, right? And because our friends don't understand what we do, you know, that's the makings of any great hobby.
Well, that's a good point. How can they find you?
So if people are interested in rental properties, you know, they're on the lower end of the network spectrum, my suggestion would be going to my podcast, Passive Cash Flow, Passive Investing, and definitely focus in on the beginning podcast, at least 12 of the first 12, because back then, 2016, when I first made the podcast, the goal was that how do you get a rental property? Where do you go? Right? What are you looking for? How do you do the numbers? All the stuff we kind of talked about today. That was kind of the focus. But as I became more of an accredited investor, as we kind of outlined today, I kind of switched, right? A lot of my strategies changed to kind of where we're at today. And it will continue to change for sure. That's the evolution. But if people are more accredited investors, you know, check out like maybe the tail end of the podcast, see what start to learn, right? It's very different things that you're taught out there. Right? Yeah, check out the podcast. SimplePassiveCashflow.com is the URL. My email address is lane@simplepassivecashflow.com. Yeah, thanks for having me, Lane.
Great. Thank you, Lane.
Thank you for joining us on The Pursuit of Learning. Make sure to hit the subscribe button and head over to our website, thepursuitoflearning.com, where you will find our show notes, transcripts, and more. If you like what you see, sign up for our mailing list. Until next time, your host in learning, Clint Murphy.